and welcome to a special edition of EW10's Bookmark. And I'm Doug Keck, your host. EW10's James Day visited the Napa Institute's 2024 summer conference, where he sat down with several popular Catholic authors to discuss their books. Here's a conversation he had with author James Matthew Wilson.
I'm pleased to be joined by James Matthew Wilson. He's the professor at University of St. Thomas in Houston. He's the Cullen Chair in English there, and he's a poet, he's a critic, and he's here to discuss his book, St. Thomas and the Forbidden Birds, 2024. And the publisher of this?
It's Word on Fire.
Word on Fire, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you for being with me.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Can you tell me a little bit about, before we get into the book, mm-hmm. which is a book of poems, tell me a little bit about your background, how you primarily see yourself sure. as an artist, mm-hmm. and some of your accomplishments.
Yeah, well, so I'm one of those kind of unusual creatures in our day. I am a poet who writes in meter and rhyme. I am trying to participate in the great tradition of verse going back to Shakespeare, going back to Homer and Virgil. And just trying to write in a contemporary idiom poems that are worth memorizing and that the average person would want to hear. So I try not to be too obscure, just trying to write good things that people can recognize easily enough as beautiful. And it's been, you know, the great joy of my life to be able to. I was hoping that maybe somebody would take an interest in a poem or two of mine. It's been great to have, over the last couple decades, published 300 poems and 4 books of poetry. To have been able to write some long poems on Catholic saints, and to write some poems specifically for the church and for use in sacred music as hymns and in parts of the liturgy. So it's been a great career so far.
Let's talk a little bit about the epic poem, or the genre of epic verse, you know, going back to Virgil,
yes.
even further with Homer. Yeah. I think a contemporary audience might forget that these are poems. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. were these poems written down, for instance?
Right.
And why you see that as important today, why you want to continue that tradition?
So poetry is the most universal of the arts. Every culture has a poetry. Even cultures that don't have a developed music tradition still have poetry. Even cultures that don't have painting or a substantial visual art dimension still have poetry. And the reason it's the most ancient and universal and widespread of the arts is because it's a medium that's memorable and that can convey to a culture everything it needs to know. And so for a contemporary reader, if a contemporary reader pays attention to poetry at all, most readers will think of poetry in the lyric vein, song, the short sonnet, the love poem, all of which is wonderful and all of which is important, and in our day, all of which is central to the art. But it's important to recognize that poetry was first and foremost a narrative form. It was a way of telling stories. So Homer's epics, Virgil's epic, the Aeneid, the great dramas of Shakespeare and Molière and Racine, these are the great ways in which stories have been told, crossing down through generations, and brought the old into the present in a memorable and new and exciting form. When poetry gives up telling stories, poetry's given up one of its most important tasks.
When did you actually start writing poetry and realize, well, this is amazing, I have a talent for this and I'd like to keep going? How old were you and what was that experience?
I wish the experience involved discovering I had a talent for it. I just fell in love with it.
300 poems and 4 books.
The great moment came sometime during my college years when I had been writing fiction for some time. I'd been writing short stories. I was even working on my first novel. And in fact, around this time, I was contacted by an agent who wanted to start working with me and trying to sell my novels. But around that same time, a professor tried to explain to me what Shakespeare was doing when he wrote iambic pentameter. What is that? I had no idea. He tried to explain it to the class, and I forget the rest of the day's work because I had my head buried in my notebook trying to write just a single line of pentameter, which I did succeed in writing, a sonnet every day for 5 long years. And I went home that night with that one line, and I wrote 13 more that rhymed according to the Shakespearean sonnet form. And when I was done, it took 5 hours to do it, but when I was done after 5 hours, I had my first sonnet. And I the experience of that was, I didn't know if it was any good. I just knew that this kind of making, this kind of chiseling away with words, was such a great joy that it was one of the best things I'd ever done. And I just wanted to keep doing it. And so I did. For the next week, I came home every night from class, had dinner with my roommates in college, and then went up to my room and wrote 4 more sonnets. And after that, I was hooked.
What's the tradition in the church of poetry and promoting poetry in general? I know that's a big question, but some examples that come to mind.
Well, so one thing that many Catholics won't know is that some of our earliest church fathers, Jacob of Sarug, for instance, were theologians, but they wrote in verse. They wrote in verse mostly because it was easy to memorize. If they wanted to convey church teaching, then to put the lines in meter would enable their listeners to hear and then retain what they were being taught. But these theologians who wrote in verse oftentimes were really great poets. So that was the beginning of the church's tradition. But it's developed, of course, since then in multiple directions. In the Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages, Prudentius, in the late Middle Ages, St. Thomas Aquinas wrote some of our greatest hymns as magnificent poems. And then who could fail to mention Dante, the greatest poet of all time, who, of course, for many of us, is the great representer and imaginer of hell, of purgatory, and heaven. In fact, I'll just say one thing. I used to teach confirmation classes at my parish when we lived in Pennsylvania, and sometimes the students would ask a tricky theological question, and I wouldn't always have a ready answer from the catechism, but I'd say, well, Dante thought of it this way, or he imagined it that way. And I think being able to imagine this life and the next, along with Dante, is one of the greatest gifts that poetry could possibly give us.
Is Gerald Manley Hopkins someone that you studied, or what was your impression on this Jesuit poet?
Yes, so he's certainly one of the best poets of the 19th century, which is saying a lot, because the 19th century was actually a great age for poetry, even though it hasn't always worn too well. For instance, Longfellow, one of my favorites, is little read today, though he should be. Alfred Lord Tennyson, also little read today, should be. Hopkins has never faded, and that's first of all because he's a weird poet, but second of all because he's a really profound poet. In the space of a sonnet, he can actually convey the whole metaphysical structure of God's creation and the way in which the things that God has created give expression to Christ himself.
Tell me a little bit about this cover first.
Sure.
We'll get to the title in a second. But this cover reminds me of a medieval illuminated manuscript. Can you expound on this? What's going on here?
It is from a medieval illuminated manuscript. This is from a medieval bestiary, and it's a depiction of an owl being persecuted, as it were, by some other species of birds. And it's a visual expression of what, to my mind, is one of the great achievements of human civilization, and that is the medieval imagination looking at the world and reading it for what it has to tell us about God's intentions. We all know that lions are brave, you know, that ostriches can be a little bit cowardly, that chickens are cute and rabbits are fertile. And these are all lessons that God has inscribed in nature for us. You know, the world is full of signs that are speaking to us all the time. Sometimes those signs we have to sort of take with tongue in cheek. Sometimes we have to take them very seriously. And so part of that reading the signs is the medieval bestiary tradition, where our ancestors would look at the animals of the world and try to explain what they meant, what they represented, and what they could teach us human beings about how to live.
How difficult is it in these days to cultivate a sense of a poetic mentality given the world around you? Do you find yourself struggling, or do you still find yourself inspired by the natural beauty, by the beauty of creation? Some struggles there, though, at the same time?
So this is actually the big struggle of our age. You often hear people talk about are living in a disenchanted age, as if the world was once full of magic, and now that magic is gone because we have the other kind of magic called science. I think that's a really naive story. Even the scientist has to be attentive to the intelligibility, the way of the world, the way in which natural phenomena speak to us and convey meaning to us, so much so that it's impossible for the physicist or the biologist to look at any phenomenon in nature and not ask, what's this for? And how does it fit into the overall cosmic pattern so that we have one truth and one whole made up of many smaller truths? And I think once you acknowledge that the world just gives itself to us as intelligible, it gives itself to us as asking to be known and to be known by us in terms that we can make sense of, you realize that the medievals weren't so naive or silly in thinking that lions represent courage. In fact, that just follows logically from the fact that there's anything at all and that we're capable of knowing reality.
Okay, tell me a little bit structurally. Mm-hmm. When you're writing a book of poems, are you writing a book of poems or are you compiling poems mm-hmm. to make a book? Mm-hmm. How did you go about formatting, deciding thematically how this book would come to be?
This is the extra joy and challenge that a poet confronts that, say, a novelist doesn't. A novelist starts writing a story and he might begin it at the beginning and he just goes till he gets to the end. A good book of poems will have a double structure. You might think of it as a temporal and a spatial one, or an auditory one and a visual one. On the one hand, it will tell some kind of story. And this book tells a story about the evil that we find in the world, but also the great meaning and intelligence and truth that we find also conveyed to us in the world, and that truth redeems the fallenness of things, just as Christ redeems us from sin. So it tells a story, but then there's also that sort of mosaic-like spatial pattern, I guess you would say, where I just want to make sure that as the reader turns each page, the reader's going to be surprised and not find one poem that was just like the last one, but will say, oh, he could do this and then he could do that, you know, and just the continuous surprise so that you don't know what's coming next, but then when you see it all, it'll be looking like at a mosaic where each individual tile forms a picture larger than the sum of the parts.
We're going to enjoy a reading from the author right now. James Matthew, can you tell us, would you mind reading us a poem of yours, and which one would you like to read?
Sure. So I'll read the title poem from St. Thomas and the Forbidden Birds. And it's a great story. A lot of people, when they read, if they do read St. Thomas's works, even though he was the author of several, you know, Eucharistic hymns, they don't necessarily think of him as a great poetic writer. In fact, to the contrary, the structures of the Summae are sort of intimidatingly intellectual and maybe not forthrightly aesthetic. But in fact, buried in there are all kinds of troves of beauty. And one day, one morning, I was reading the treatise on law, and Aquinas begins talking about the Mosaic Law. And he goes through all of the birds that Mosaic Law, kosher law, forbade the ancient Jews to eat. And he gives a moral explanation for why each one was forbidden. And I just thought, this is a poem. This is a beautiful poem. I just want to put it in rhyme. I'm just going to let Thomas Aquinas speak, but I'll measure out his speech and put it in rhyme and just see what happens. By the time I'd taken some of his bird interpretations and put them into verse, I could see Thomas Aquinas sitting in his chapel, a chapel I visited, where he was writing the Summa. I could see him talking to his amanuenses who wrote everything down for him, and I thought, I know this is not just putting Thomas Aquinas in verse, this is going to be a poem, and it ended up being, I think, one of my favorite poems and what I wanted to dedicate a book to, because I think it says a lot both about the church, about Aquinas, and about the beauty of things. So I'll read it for you.
Thank you for setting that tone.
St. Thomas and the Forbidden Birds. Beyond the window, morning sparrows made their song as if the whole world's goodness paid its plenty out for them and them alone. The old saint heard their joy and squelched a moan as his legs, stiff and heavy still with sleep, arranged themselves beneath his cassocked heap of belly. Where had he left off before? He asked his three amanuenses, more for their sake, sprightly fingers, sluggish minds than his. One said, with the forbidden kinds of birds and what their figures signified for Moses, who charged the eagle's flight with pride. Aquinas sat a moment, mind withdrawn from his mouth's taste of buttered loaves, the dawn without, the wish for more wood in the fire to clear the frost from stone, or to admire the cool, swift brilliance of all he said, as a swan plumes its white and well-turned head. He spoke. The long-beaked ibis feeds on snakes to represent the man whom nothing slakes. Feasting upon dead bodies' open gore, the vulture stands for all who thrive through war. When Noah let the raven out to fly, it never did return to signify such men whose souls are blackened by foul lust, or who, unkind, won't pay back trust with trust. The plodding puffball ostrich is that which figures all those weighed down with growing rich. and hearing God's call, plant their soiled head. Plovers, like gossips on stray words, are fed. And who, on seeing the gull, does not admire that its bright wings to heaven may aspire? And yet it wastes its hours adrift at sea, gorging on fishy sensuality. The hoopoe builds its nest on heaps of dung, just as despair's eyes view the world all wrong. He paused then at the thought of earthly sorrows, our sickly past, incarnadine tomorrows, the myriad things that whistle arcane truth to please old minds and to instruct raw youth, and bore down on his broken knees to pray for such a world that had so much to say.
What are your students? You have a lot of students coming in, all walks of life. How do they respond to this kind of poetry, which is not poetry for poetry's sake? It's talking about something greater than the words.
So, you know, in one way, all poetry is for poetry's sake. I think when we read a poem, and when we read it with attention and concentration to attend to the language of the poem, to the figures of speech, to the metrical order and the use of rhyme, we're encountering one of the most important lessons we can learn, which is that God made things as good in themselves, that most things are intrinsic goods. There are many, the world's full of useful goods, but most things are things that are worth thinking about and appreciating for why God made them in the first place. So when we just stop and attend to a poem, we are encountering in a rudimentary form the kind of contemplation that prayer involves and that our life in heaven will involve when we concentrate on God, who's the good itself, who's a good for his own sake because he is the source of all goodness and the cause of all goodness. But on the other hand, the beauty of poetry is that simultaneously it can be, for its own sake, it can be a beautiful thing just worth contemplating. But when a poem is really good, just like Aquinas talking about the nature of the birds, it's always speaking beyond itself, and it's opening up a bigger world to us. And I think that's the great challenge of the poet, simultaneously to make something good, to make a good work of craft, but to make it speak in such a way that people will say, oh, this helps me think about the world anew and to see into the life of things.
So let's talk about how you're actualizing this in your everyday life. I think it's important for audiences to know that you are constantly thinking about beauty, art, and the faith. Am I right? I don't want to assume, but
yeah,
that's my thought.
Uh-huh.
So how are you doing that?
Well, I'm doing it in a few ways. One thing I would want to mention is I founded and now direct the Master of Fine Arts program in Creative Writing at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. And that is a graduate program that's mostly online. And it is a school of the Catholic imagination. We wanted to train a generation of writers to write great works of art that are just good and of intrinsic interest to anyone, but which also speak of the profound metaphysical and theological truths that the church has to share with us. And you might say, what does that mean? Is this a kind of apologetic exercise? No, not really, even though we do hope that it will bring people into the church who are not there now. The fact is that literature is one of the great ways in which human beings know themselves and they know the world. But most contemporary literature doesn't take that responsibility very seriously. And so we are trying to restore literature as a way of knowing the world so that everybody can just enter more deeply into this world, understand themselves, understand the nature of things, understand their responsibility as moral agents and as people with a destiny beyond the horizon of this world. Stories do that. Poems remind us of that. And so we just want to help young writers, aspiring writers, learn how to do that again the way the great writers of the past were able to do it.
How do you navigate the conflict, the tension between wanting to pursue a life in beauty and art and the reality of paying bills and dealing with the world around us, which really a lot of the world, even the practical world, wants nothing to do with this kind of beauty and pursuit of art. And yet it is a beautiful world, and it is a very poetic world that surrounds us every day. We have this opportunity to be part of this great experiment of being on this planet. But so how do you tell the students about prepare for reality, but continue to pursue this passion?
That's right. I mean, very few people have ever made a living of the arts, at least by itself. But that's not necessary. I think most people should learn the basic crafts of how to tell a good story, how to write a good story, how to write in meter and to write a poem. At the very least, we all need to know how to write a good poem so that we can propose to the woman we want to become our wife. You know, we all have these duties and responsibilities where we have to learn to use language well. So part of it is simply saying this is just another good thing that we can do. But there's another dimension to it, and that is that that when we engage in this world, we are serving other people, we're serving the church, we're serving God. And so it's not in competition with the other activities that we have, including our prayer life and our spiritual life. It's actually a complement to them.
Let's talk about, back to the, there was a poem there in the book where it was referencing Cicero. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's not in front of me, but is it on the death of Cicero?
The death of Cicero, yes.
What were you going for with that? Yes. Why Cicero?
Yes, so if readers were able to, or your listeners were able to take in that poem on Thomas Aquinas I just read, there are sort of two big themes that emerge in that poem. One is Aquinas's identification with his empathy with the sufferings of the world, and that this is a fallen world, but also his recognition that it's an intelligible world. It's a world that has so much to say, that's speaking to us and calling us to a life that's better than the one most of us are living. And I wanted the book as a whole to trace that arc. And so there are three poems in the book as a whole that deal with the most gruesome aspects of human life. So one is about the bombing of Dresden, the carpet bombing of that city during the Second World War, which was one of the most devastating, if in some respects defensible, acts of the American government during the war. Another one on the diaries of Maria Monk is actually a sort of tangential way of exploring the great wound of the sexual abuse crisis in the church and what we've been through. And then the third poem of the fallenness of the world is the death of Cicero. So Cicero is a great orator, great statesman, and Roman philosopher. And he suffered a cruel death by at Antony's hands in the late days of the Roman Empire. And I wanted to just that led to the empire. And what I wanted to convey in Cicero's case was just recognizing something that people have recognized since the death of Cicero, that virtue does not always pay, and that sometimes the innocent and the just and the noble do suffer cruel fates. And that's one of the mysteries that we have to understand, accept, and pass through as Christians in the world. So I thought he, as a sort of, as a noble Gentile, you might say, or as someone outside of the church, but nonetheless representing the sort of natural virtues in an impressive way, and also by his death representing the catastrophe that so much of history sometimes has been, I thought narrating his death would be a good way to capture that aspect of human experience.
You touched on this in your answer just now, but there is a lot about America, mm-hmm. the country, mm-hmm. the place, the physicality, not so much in a religious element. I mean, there is that aspect mm-hmm. to it, right? Would you say that this is a political work, or tell me a little bit about your weaving in the American experience?
Well, I'd have to actually refer to a different book than this one to really answer that correctly. So about 5 years ago, I wrote a long poem, book-length poem, called The River of the Immaculate Conception. And it was a poem about the presence of Catholics and Catholicism in the Americas from the Spanish conquest and the first Jesuit missions sent down the St. Lawrence Seaway by the French, as well as the conversion of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton and the normalization, you might say, of Catholicism on a continent where it had once not existed. And it's been my belief for a very long time, because one of the things I was conveying in that poem was something I learned in fourth grade in St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic School in East Lansing, Michigan, and that is, looked at properly, America, not the United States, but the Americas, is a Catholic country. And what I mean by that is that from the beginning, Mass has been said in this land. From the beginning, there have been priests like Father Marquette who have discovered the previously undiscovered lands, such as the Mississippi, and consecrated them to the Blessed Virgin, consecrated them to the Immaculate Conception. Father Marquette called the Mississippi River the River of the Immaculate Conception. What does that mean? Did they conquer the land? No. They came to pray for it. They came to act out through God's grace whatever God wanted them to do. It's not about planting a flag. It's about bringing God's word where it was not before and being attentive, whether we live in Maryland or San Francisco or Los Angeles, these great Catholic place names, being attentive not to what we do, but to what God's doing among us. This is a lesson I learned in fourth grade from my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Rambo. It's also a lesson that John Paul II wanted to teach us all in his letter, Ecclesia in America, where he called Americans, yes, which is a beautiful vision of what America is, whether we appreciate it that way or not.
So that continued with you. I mean, that wasn't just that particular project, which is a beautiful project. You actually, I believe you read some of it at a previous Napa event. It continues here.
Yes.
In the same vein of what you were trying to do with the previous, with the long poem, or is this in a new light, a new focus?
Well, so I'm trying never to repeat myself too much, but I'm also trying to finish what needs to be said. So I've been elaborating things a little bit here. You might be thinking of some of the hymns. Well, I did a hymn for St. Philip Neri in this book, which was a great joy to compose. What a magnificent man he was, and to get to capture in that poem something that I first learned from Cardinal Newman when I was reading in his autobiography why he became an oratorian, and it was because he saw that St. Philip Neri would just sit and wait for people to come to him, and then his ears would be entirely open to them, and they could pour out their souls to him. But he would also seem to know what they weren't saying. He just was such a perceptive listener that he could hear into the hearts of people. So I wanted to celebrate him in a hymn that could be sung, and it's been set to music and been performed in several places, including in several oratories. One other thing that I try to do, I want to write in traditional forms. I want to write in the great forms that if you grew up reading Shakespeare and Tennyson and Homer, you'll know that what I'm doing is a poem. You can hear it right away. But I think it's one of the poet's tasks to take contemporary moments, the things that are singularly of our moment, and maybe ephemerally so, as in 10 years from now, people will find this or that phenomenon or aspect of pop culture completely foreign and alien, but to take those passing ephemeral aspects of the contemporary life and try to give them permanent forms so that we can understand them better and to see their inner meaning. And so I try to be at once rigorously traditional but also ruthlessly contemporary when I'm writing about this or that aspect of our day.
James Matthew Wilson, he's the poet behind St. Thomas and the Forbidden Birds.
Yes.
Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much, James.
And that was EWTN's James Day speaking with author and poet James Matthew Wilson about his book, St. Thomas and the Forbidden Birds, published by Word on Fire Press, and of course available through our EWTN religious catalog, EWTNRC.com, for all things Catholic. I'm Doug Keck. Thanks for joining us for this special edition of Bookmark.